Danao Mengistu weaves together the stories of two generations of an Ethiopian-American family in his latest novel, How to Read the Air. His narrator is Jonas Waldemariam, a young high school English teacher who tries to recreate his parents' troubled marriage on paper and, in alternating chapters, his journey to understand their relationship while his own marriage is falling apart. The New Yorker recently named Mr. Mengistu to its list of 20 under 40 fiction writers to watch, and his first novel, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, won a number of prizes, including the 5 under 35 award from the National Book Foundation. This book is published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me again.
When your novel opens, the narrator's parents, Yosef and Mariam, are a young married couple from Ethiopia who've recently been reunited in Peoria, Illinois, after a three-year separation. Why Peoria? Does it have a large community of Ethiopian immigrants?
As far as I know, there's not a very large, if sizable or noticeable, population of Ethiopians. But when my family immigrated from Ethiopia when I was 2 years old, my father had left the country just before us, and he came to Peoria. And so my mother, sister, and I, eventually when we left, we joined him in Peoria. And when I began writing this novel, I really wanted to return to that landscape and to that perspective that I thought my parents might have had.
Well, to some degree, this is based on that experience, although you were born in Addis Ababa, and your narrator here was born in Peoria.
Yeah.
But why had they been separated for so long, so soon after they were married? Was their marriage a love match, or had it been arranged?
For my parents?
Mm-hmm.
No, for my parents, it was very much a love match. But it was about about 2 years after they'd been married, that my father sort of felt the situation in Ethiopia was a little bit too risky and too dangerous for him. And so they decided together that he was going away to Europe on a business trip, and the best thing for him and for us would be if he did not return, because there was very little security and there was very little guarantee of his safety. And so they chose together for him to leave and for us to eventually join him. And, of course, at the time, both my parents thought it would just be a temporary thing, that he would come to America or he would flee to Europe and eventually we would join him, and then some time later I'll come back to Ethiopia. But obviously it never worked out that way.
Well, he was escaping the country's repressive regime. Is it just a coincidence that the dictatorship he was fleeing was headed by a man named Mengistu?
Just
very close to yours. Is this a common name
exactly.
in Ethiopia?
No, it's just a fairly common name. There's fortunately no relationship.
Did many of the Ethiopians now living in the U.S. leave during that time?
Definitely a sizable number began to leave at that time. Until then, there hadn't been a large Ethiopian diaspora. And since then, you know, once this process of sort of migration begins, I think it just continues. And so now there's still a sizable Ethiopian population that's growing across the U.S. And they're not necessarily leaving, obviously, because of the same political regime. People are continually leaving.
Although there still are political problems in Ethiopia. I know I've done
Without
a number
doubt.
Of shows about that. You couldn't have much of a memory of Ethiopia. You left when you were two.
No, I had absolutely none at all.
As we said, your novel's protagonist, Jonas, was born in the U.S., so it bothers him when his students ask him where he's from. They're not satisfied when he tells them he's from Illinois. But, you know, this is a way people often try to open up a conversation. At least in New York, I think it's probably the first thing people ask the cab driver.
No, of course, very much. And in this case, you know, I think the narrator's very determined to try to identify himself as being American. And that was something I was very interested in playing with inside of the novel, is definitely creating a novel that was distinctly sort of American in location and scope and by narration as well. And at the same time, being able to show how sort of complicated that identity can and eventually becomes over the course of the story.
Well, he actually becomes annoyed when his wife, Angela, who is a more typical African-American, her family's roots go back a long time here, she asks New York drivers where they're from.
Yeah, and he himself is very sort of cynical about that construction of the immigrant narrative. It's become such a almost cliche and automatic trope where people will, you know, sort of just lump all stories together as one generic immigrant story. And he's very aware of that. And it takes him a while inside of the novel before he eventually gives in and tries to understand the complexity of that narrative. But for him initially, he knows that these stories all fall into a general pattern in listeners' or readers' minds, and he's willing to play with that.
How much of a culture clash is there between people who recently came from Africa, and people whose African roots go back to slavery days?
I would say the individual and collective histories are so radically different. African Americans are a fabric of America. They are part of the founding of the country, and they're the ones who have sort of endured most of its hardships and most of its brutalities. African immigrants are sort of fairly new phenomenon in America, and you know, they sort of arrive, I think, with the same freedom that most immigrants come to America with. It's not with an expectation that they can rebuild and recreate their lives and go on to great and better things without any historical burden behind them.
They're often shocked about how little Americans know about Africa.
Of course.
Whether Ghana is in West Africa, yeah, and Kenya is in East Africa. That leads to some resentments. On the other hand, American blacks tell me that when they go to Africa and feel like they're returning home, they're treated as Americans.
Of course.
Might as well be white.
Yeah, there's very little difference in, obviously, I mean, economically, there's such a vast difference between an American returning to Africa. And it's hard to sort of assume all of Africa is going to be the same uniform continent. It's not.
So are Americans particularly insensitive to these things? And would somebody with this kind of background feel freer in another country like France, where you live these days?
I don't think it's a question of insensitivity. I think actually Americans are always deeply compelled and curious by that question of origin and where people come from. I think it's less a question of insensitivity and more a question of perhaps overfamiliarity or a sense that they've become overfamiliarized and that these things have become sort of they've lost their nuance to people. And it's hard to sort of argue for their particularity because people feel like they already know the story, and the immigrant narrative has become, you know, sort of risks running becoming a cliche in a certain way. And so I think Americans are deeply fascinated by the immigrant narrative, but I think they need to sort of hear it retold in a way that also allows them to understand that it's very much an essential American narrative. It's not a sort of distinct part of American literature or American stories. It's very much the fabric of American writing.
Jonas also refuses to take part in an effort his students launched to raise money for people in Africa, and they're puzzled by his unwillingness. He tells the students he can't help because his parents are Irish.
Yeah, you know, and again, I think that plays to some of his cynicism about the way Africa and African problems are often sort of treated and easily summarized, with the idea that Africa or certain conflicts can be ended or saved just by a matter of dictation on the part of the West. And I remember after doing a trip to Darfur, coming back to New York and being at a Stop Genocide rally in the Central Park, and it felt more like a festival for college students than it did a real engagement with issues surrounding Darfur, and I found that sort of very well-intentioned but very problematic.
This is a novel as much as anything about troubled marriages in two generations. In the case of Jonas and Angela, is it a matter of attraction of opposites? He almost never speaks, and she's always ready with a contrary opinion.
It's definitely opposites, and definitely I think two people who share deeply difficult pasts, and they both have wounded histories that they're trying to heal from. And I think that's part of their initial draw to each other, as well as the sense that, you know, they both have had difficult relationships with their parents, and perhaps together they can sort of form a union that will endure and that will actually make them both more whole and complete individuals. And what they find, of course, is that unless they're able to actually communicate openly and work together, that those burdens in that past will still always infect their marriage.
Well, sometimes communication in these marriages is more physical than in a bad way.
Yeah.
Hit each other.
Exactly. And for them, you know, Jonas is, because he's had such a violent relationship with his father, he tries very hard to construct his identity in opposition to that. And so he's never violent with his wife, but in turn, he's never open with her as well. He retreats inside himself completely as a way of making sure he never crosses a certain threshold that his father did.
His father gets into a fight with his new bride. Well, not his new bride, but when she's come to America, Yosef and Miriam take a trip from Peoria to Nashville, although I wondered why they would go to Nashville. It's pretty obvious from the start that there are problems between them. Miriam delays getting into the car because she's annoyed with him, and then soon after, Yosef shoves her so hard that she hits her head on the window and blacks out. So, I mean, does he expect something from her that she's not providing?
You know, I think by the time he gets to America, his history and the sort of journey that he has to make in order to migrate out of Africa and into America takes its toll on him. It radically alters his sense of who he is, and it, I think, deeply damages him in a way that he's unable to control. And that violence, or that expression of violence, is very much, I think, a reflection of the own political and physical violence that he endured coming out of Africa. And for him, that's just retranslated in America into domestic violence.
Well, would it have been the way a husband might typically have reacted in Ethiopia?
No. I mean, you know, it's obviously it depends on certain families and individuals and communities, but it's not something that would have been sort of generally allowed by the culture.
My guest is Dinau Mengistu. His latest novel, How to Read the Air, it's published by Riverhead. Jonas recalls other times when, as a child, he saw his father strike his mother, that she'd even come to sleep in his bed at night sometimes to avoid Yosef. So he learned to be as inconspicuous as possible at an early age to avoid angering his father.
Yeah, and that very much translates into his life as an adult, where he lives a bit on the margins, and he has very few attachments to people, and tries to sort of be as kind of discreet and humble as he possibly can, because even though his father is no longer part of his life, he still maintains the sense of fear, and that fear is kind of really what haunts him and what kind of shapes his personality.
His motto is, whatever can't see you can't hurt you.
Yeah.
He and Angela meet in New York City when they're both working for an organization that helps refugees. And they're drawn to each other partly because they're the only African-Americans working in that office?
Yeah, and that's their sort of first initial sense, is that they can be more mocking and more playful with the idea of the immigrant and refugee stories that they work with at the center. And that sort of sense of humor is something that they don't see reflected in the other colleagues that they have at the office, but it brings them together.
Well, we were just talking about male-female roles in the American workplace, and that's something that you actually deal with here. She's a lawyer, so her job is well-defined.
Yeah.
He, on the other hand, tells her that he plans to get his PhD in poetry and literature, and he has a less-defined role in this organization.
Yeah, he's more of just a sort of general office assistant who gets assigned this strange task of actually modifying or sometimes completely inventing the immigrant narratives that he's told in the office in order to help these people actually go through the asylum process to make sure their stories are visibly, notably tragic enough in order to make them acceptable.
Well, he's constantly inventing. He later becomes a high school teacher of English, but he spends less time teaching his students the English language and more telling them stories, exaggerated stories.
Yeah, and he's he has two elements. He tells lies sometimes to protect himself and to hide from difficult things. And then he invents stories, especially the one he tells his students, as a way of really negotiating with his family's history and really kind of coming to terms with his past and with his father and giving real life to his father's past through the act of fiction. And that for him becomes a way of kind of releasing some of his anger and some of his pain and coming to kind of a complete sense of who he is.
And later he tries to work out what his father was all about by retracing his parents' trip from Peoria to Nashville. He does it alone. What can you learn by taking a road trip?
Definitely the road trip in the novel is, I guess there's two of them. Part of it was there's a great American tradition of road trips and road trips in work, in fiction as well. And I wanted the novel to be able to embrace that, but to do it from obviously a perspective, I think that's sort of unfamiliar to readers and completely new for me. And when I first came, after I first visited Ethiopia, I came straight back to Peoria, Illinois by car. Once I reached Chicago, and I was very curious in seeing how these two different landscapes can be sort of melded in one person's mind, and of course that ends up being reflected in the novel.
The title of the book comes from something Yosef held to be true. Can you tell us what it means to read the air?
It's a deliberately open title. In the literal sense of the novel, it's about being able to perceive and notice the subtle changes that occur between two people before something violent or something damaging occurs, and it's being able to notice that subtlety is for Yosef a matter of how to read the air. And then I think more cryptically, it's also a matter of knowing how to understand and interpret.
This novel and your earlier novel have gotten terrific reviews. The Library Journal even said that your prose, quote, flows like liquid gold, Critics have compared you to Bellow, Naipaul, Fitzgerald. Not bad writers to be compared to.
No, not at all.
Although I see you blushing. Near the end of his highly complimentary review of this book in last Sunday's New York Times Book Review, Miguel Sayuko suggested that he'd like to see you tackle the subject beyond the immigrant experience. Is that a reasonable request?
No, I don't think so. I think it's to sort of say that somehow the immigrant experience is a subject, and for me, it's not one subject that somebody conquers and then moves on to the next any more than the subject of love or friendship or relationships or compassion. These are all sort of vast parts of our experience and our identity. And the immigrant narrative is not something that you, once you've sort of done it, you're supposed to suddenly jump on into a new bandwagon and move to the next story because you've somehow completed your goal of understanding what that experience is.
Well, you've only recently celebrated your 30th birthday, so still got a lot of time to write that non-immigrant novel somewhere down the line.
Without a doubt.
I'm assuming that there is a third one in the works.
There is, very, very quietly, slowly in the works.
Uh-huh. I'm assuming that immigration is somehow a part of it.
There's always a migration element, I think, to the narrative. Sometimes I think, you know, people don't always arrive in the place that they're in. And I think with this novel, and probably more so with the third novel, it is very much about people being dispersed around the world, both in America and in Europe.
Do you visit Ethiopia these days?
I was there last year for about 3 weeks. Actually, fortunately, driving around the country, which was a sort of fantastic way to see it.
And, of course, that's a major part of the plot of this book, driving around the United States.
Exactly.
Although Peoria to Nashville, I don't know. Danao, Mengistu will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca. That's on Warren and Greenwich Streets. The book, How to Read the Air, is published by Riverhead. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much for having me again.